I love that one, Tommy. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Good morning, church. So good to see you guys. And I tell you what, I think Peter said it well. If you missed out on our play, the presentation that our kids and their teachers put on earlier, you really missed out on a treat. There were so many stars. I mean, the angels and... it was just obvious that they cast the right people for the right part. Mary was full of faith. It was every part was just it was just great. The shepherds so believable, and the manger wrangler. If you missed her performance, she was really good. Coming and getting baby Jesus, just so. With all of the, there was no bigger star than Stella, obviously, but she did a great job too as the star, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. So I hope that if you missed it this year, you get to come back next year and see it, because it is definitely worth seeing. Now, there are a lot of things we think about this time of year, but I want to tell you something that people who are less honest think about this time of year. It's that a lot of people are doing a lot of online purchasing. And that means there are more people whose digital information is available. People do, you've probably experienced this at some point in your life. It's called identity theft. And it's where someone takes your identity or claims to be someone that. How many of you have had to deal with someone stealing your identity or using your credit card, something along those lines? How many of you had to do that? Look at all you suckers. I am telling you. Now, it's happened to me. It's happened to me multiple times, if I'm being honest. People get your credit card numbers. Sometimes there'll be a data breach, and they'll get it through Target or get it through some online retailer. Sometimes you buy things on Amazon, and it turns out that the seller on Amazon is a fake seller or something like that. And sometimes people will contact you, and they'll pretend to be a government agency and say, oh, there's a warrant out for your arrest, or you're behind on your taxes, or your computer has a virus. We represent your computer company or your software company, and there's all sorts of ways to get your identity. But when someone pretends to be someone that they really aren't, we all recognize it, that there are some serious consequences that go along like that. So if someone opens up an account in your name, for instance, opens up a bank account or a credit card account and runs up a big bill, and then it places a burden on you that you don't deserve, right? When someone pretends to be the IRS or the sheriff's department or your software company, if you believe them, if they have a believable story and you buy it, it could cost you thousands of dollars, right? So I think that we would all generally agree that the world would be a lot better place if everyone, you and me and everyone in the world, would all just own our own identity. That would make the world better. If you would be you and I could be me and they could be them, and just let everybody own their own identity. The strange thing about Mark's gospel, the gospel of Mark, about the life of Jesus, is that for most of the gospel, Jesus doesn't do that. At least not in the way you would expect. He just sort of skirts the question. To be clear, Jesus never lied. He never misrepresented who he was. He was never deceptive about who he was. But at the same time, he largely avoided the question. When people asked, who are you? He would give them some sort of vague answer or not answer at all. As far as we know in the story of Mark's gospel, Jesus has only revealed his identity out of the thousands of people he's interacted with. The only people he has revealed his identity to is a very small, very select group of his followers. He never announces publicly who he is. And now they know he's Jesus of Nazareth, don't get me wrong, but they don't really know who he is. So now we come to this part of Mark's story about Christ, and Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane. He gets arrested. There was the whole betrayal by Judas. He's been arrested. He's been questioned before the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was the ruling body of Jewish leaders. It had chief priests and scribes and elders. And this group of people really had it out for Jesus. And so they just kind of took the approach of throwing everything against the wall to see what sticks. So they're hoping they'll have some reason, come up with some valid reason to get him killed. This is not the usual approach to justice. This is not how you go about justice. Normally, what you're supposed to do is say, well, this is the accusation. It seems that this guy stole, or he lied, or he cheated, or he killed, or he claims these things. Well, is this true? Let's find out if this accusation is true. And if we find it out to be true, here are the prescribed punishments. That's what justice is supposed to look like. That's not what happened with Jesus. They were like, we need to kill him. Let's talk to him long enough. We can find out he did something wrong. I mean, it's just a whole case of bad police work. It'd be like you getting pulled over and the policeman says, listen, now I guess you're wondering why I stopped you. And you say, yes, I am wondering, officer. And he goes, well, let's talk about it for a little bit. You'd be like, well, wait a minute. You don't have a reason for stopping me? Was I speeding, officer? No. Are my tags out of date? No. Did I make an illegal turn? No. Have I done something? Well, let's talk about it for a little while. And let me see if I can talk to you long enough that I can figure out something you might have done wrong. Well, that would be it would be unconstitutional for one in our country, but it would be suspicious. But that's what they've done with Jesus. We know we want to convict him. We know we want to get him killed. How can we make that happen? So that's what they've been doing. They finally decided, after throwing all these different accusations against him, they finally decided they can get him with blasphemy. Now, that's not true. It's not a true accusation. You know it's not true, and the people who are accusing him, they know it's not true too. And so in their minds, blasphemy is a death sentence. You can't go around blaspheming God, right? But it's the best case they've got. But that leaves them with a really big problem. Because Israel at this time is not an independent nation. They are an occupied state of the Roman Empire, which means that Roman officials are the only ones who get to decide if there's a death penalty. You don't get to go and do your own death penalty without any consultation. So they have to convince the governor, in this case, Pontius Pilate, to kill Jesus. That's their goal. We know he blasphemed. We need to get Pontius Pilate to kill Jesus. The problem is, this is the big one though, Pontius Pilate doesn't give two flips about blasphemy. He's not Jewish. That's not breaking any Roman laws. That's a religious law. I don't care if he broke your religious law. I'm not going to kill somebody because you don't like the way he does his religion. So there's no way that Pilate is going to condemn Jesus to death for a law he doesn't care anything about. That's not why I'm here. I am not sent here to be a judge and jury over your religious law. So the leaders of the Sanhedrin, they make up a plan. And instead of telling Pilate that Jesus is guilty of blasphemy, they think up a charge that will really get Pilate's attention. They're going to tell Pilate that Jesus has been claiming to be the king of Israel. Now, normally, we need to kind of understand the setup here. Normally, Pilate doesn't live in Jerusalem. That's not his house. He lives in Caesarea, which was the local kind of governing area, the capital of the area. He lives in Caesarea. It's a Greek city. Not too far, actually, from Nazareth, but that's where he lived. So when he comes to Jerusalem, which is a big Jewish city, obviously, and he comes there because it's the Passover, which means thousands and thousands and thousands of Jewish people are pouring in there. It's a feast day. It's a day of nationalist pride. Things could get out of hand. So Pilate's job on these occasions was to leave his home and come into Jerusalem and just make sure things don't get too wild. That's what he's doing. He doesn't have a home there that we know about. It's most likely that he's staying in Herod's palace. You just take a temporary residence up in the king's palace there in Jerusalem. So that's where he is, somewhere in Jerusalem, probably Herod's palace, when this case, the case of Jesus, is brought to him. And this is what we're told. Very early in the morning, which we think that's when the Roman officials would normally hear cases. Early in the morning, that's court day. So early in the morning, the chief priests and the elders and the teachers of the law and the whole Sanhedrin made their plans. They bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. "Are you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate. "You have said so," Jesus replied. So, you've probably heard this before, but what's difficult to convey are the subtle, small, numerous levels of irony that are sort of tucked into this very simple passage. First off, Pilate asked Jesus, "Is he as king of the Jews?" while he is standing in Herod's palace. Herod's palace. Herod is the king of Israel. Herod is at least in name, and by the way, he's not a descendant of David. He was appointed by the Roman government to be the king of Israel. So he's standing in this king's opulent palace, and he's looking at this poor, beaten peasant man, a nobody from some backwater village in the boondocks. And he has to be wondering, if this guy says he's king, he's crazy, right? That's what he's thinking. This guy, this poor guy is delusional. And then when he gives him the title, he gets the title all wrong. King of the Jews. That's not a title. That's not a real title. It's the king of Israel. You don't claim to be king of a people. You claim to be the king of the land, right? It's not the king of the English or the king of the French. It's the king of England or the king of France. But Pilate is trying to put all this together, and he's like, well, it's a religious position that is somehow associated with kingship. So he just kind of puts his Gentile interpretation on the Jewish title of Messiah and king of Israel and kind of matches them together, comes up with king of the Jews. It's a title that's going to follow Jesus all the way to the cross. It's the title that's going to be written above his head. And those titles were not meant to be an honor. They were a mocking gesture because it's not a real title. Can you imagine going to around town in Manchester and you see a guy standing by the side of the road? He's got on a Burger King crown, and he's wearing some red towel draped over his shoulders, and he's holding in his hands a sign that says the King of Manchester, right? Well, you'd know that's not real, because Manchester doesn't have a king. That's not a real position. So when they did those things to Jesus, it's not a real position. It's a way to dismiss him. It's a way to write him off. It's a little bit loony. And these titles were meant to mock Jesus, to make fun of Jesus. Because the idea that anybody could be king, this guy could be king of anything, that's ludicrous. It would be like you wander around and seeing a construction worker. They just got off work, they've got their work clothes on, and they are filthy dirty, and you're like, oh, are you the president of the United States? Now, even in our modern democratic society, where anybody can be elected president, in theory, even in our society, we would know this guy's probably not the president of the United States. If you'd never met the president of the United States, if you didn't know what his name was, didn't know what he looked like, and you just saw a construction worker, you wouldn't think maybe this guy's. No, because presidents don't get dirty. Presidents don't wear work clothes. Presidents don't get down in the dirt and get blisters on their hands. That's just not what presidents do, right? At least not anymore. So we would know better than that. Kings are different. Kings are a breed apart. They are literally, in most societies, a breed apart. They have not only the genetics, but they've got the money, they've got the power. More than that, they've got the powerful connections, the friends. Jesus doesn't have any of those things. So nobody's going to actually think Jesus is a king, at least not in a political sense. Finally, though, throughout Mark's gospel, Jesus has been avoiding this very question of who are you? And we've been wanting Jesus for a long time to answer the question. People are asking, you know, who are you? Who are you? We want Jesus to tell them. Just tell them, Jesus. Just tell them who you are so they'll follow you, right? Just tell them you are the Messiah. Just tell them you're the Son of God. We've been wanting him to do it, and he hasn't been doing it. And now, in the one position where he's being questioned who you are, and we're like, whoa, 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 don't say anything. Just don't say anything. You know, you can keep on ministering. He may cut you loose. You can go back. You can heal more people. You can teach more people. You can go around and gather more followers. Just don't say anything, Jesus, like you have been doing the whole rest of the book. The one position we want him not to answer the question, and Jesus comes right out and says it. He says, you have said so. It's a straightforward answer of yes, but in a really odd way. It's something like saying, this is true, but your idea of kingship is really different than my idea of kingship. Or I am the king of the Jews, but that doesn't mean what you think it means. I'm not a king in the way you're thinking of a king. Now, Jesus never claimed to be the king of Israel, to be perfectly clear. Never claimed to be the king of Israel in any political sense. Jesus never had any political ambition. He never ran for public office, right? He never went to the Herod's palace and says, I've got the proof that I'm a descendant of David. I actually should be in place here. He never gathered up an army and took that. He never sought any sort of political power. That was not his mission. But through his suffering and his death, he became the king, not only of the Jews, but of all people. So in this critical moment, even when faced with the prospect of his own death, Jesus owns his own identity. And so here we sit, you know, thousands of years and thousands of miles removed, and we kind of have to answer this same question all the time. Who are you? More importantly, are you who you claim to be? Are you really who you claim to be? One of the great difficulties we encounter in our culture is that the majority of the people we meet, I mean, you just go out and you throw a rock in a Walmart parking lot on a Black Friday, you're going to hit someone who claims to be a Christian. That's just the way our culture is around here. Most of the time, most of the people we encounter at work or in our community claim to be Christians in some sense of the word. They may not be a part of a church. They may not read the Bible. May not have ever read the Bible. May not have committed their lives to Christ. May not pray. May not live by any sort of biblical moral code. But in their minds, at least, they are Christians. Maybe because their meemaw was a Christian, maybe because they have a Bible in their home, maybe because that's where they feel like they identify politically, but for some reason they're going to claim Christian in this part of the country, at least. So what's more troubling is that someone might do all of those things. They might go to church. They might read the Bible. They might pray. They might put money in the collection plate. Might do all of those things, but never actually give their lives to Christ. They might go through a ceremony, might be baptized, or what some other churches do to bring people into the fold, so to speak, and make them one of them. They may do all of that without ever actually committing their lives to Christ. You can do all of that. Earlier in Mark's gospel, Jesus was accused by some Pharisees of not teaching his followers to keep the laws. There were laws about ritual washings, laws about, you know, when and how you can eat and all that stuff. And when they accused Jesus of not teaching his followers the laws, this is what he said. He said, Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you, you hypocrites, as it's written. These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. In other words, there is a big difference between saying you are one of God's and living like you're one of God's. There is a big difference between honoring God with your mouth and honoring God with your life. Jesus did not descend to earth to live and walk among us and die a cruel death on the cross so that one day people in Manchester, Tennessee could stand up and say that they were one of his followers. Jesus didn't do that. Jesus did that so that people in Manchester, Tennessee could actually follow him. He doesn't care if you just say you're his follower. He wants you to actually follow him. John 1:12 says, yet to all who did receive him, right? To actively receive him, to those who believed in his name, like just became followers of his, to those people he gave the right to become children of God. This last Wednesday night, we've been going through on our Wednesday night Bible study, we've been going through the whole Bible, and we're doing awesome at it. And we've been taking like one book a week, generally. And this last week, we got to the book of Hosea, and we're not going to go all into it or anything, but the prophet kind of lays out a case against Israel. It's a prophecy against the nation of Israel, and he kind of lays out a case against them because of they're worshiping idols, and they're being unjust towards the poor people and the widows, the orphans, and all that. And then specifically, in Hosea chapter 4, verse 6, he says, my people are destroyed from a lack of knowledge. My people are destroyed from a lack of knowledge. Now, these people, the descendants, they're descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? They are the people of God. And they are being destroyed because they do not know God. Now, the problem wasn't that Israel quit teaching the law in the schools. It wasn't that Israel quit using the Torah in schools, or because they were using a bad translation of the law, the books of Moses. No, they knew the law. They knew the Ten Commandments. In other words, the problem was that we were committing idolatry because we didn't know idolatry wasn't wrong. We didn't know idolatry was wrong. We didn't know we weren't supposed to worship other gods. So what does he mean they're being destroyed from a lack of knowledge? The problem isn't that they did not know this knowledge in their heads. The problem was they didn't know this knowledge in their hearts. They had it here. They didn't have it here. They knew it intellectually. They did not know it experientially because they never actually did it. It would be like me saying, I know woodworking because I watch woodworking videos. Or you saying, I know football because I've watched a lot of football games. Or anything we claim to have knowledge of without ever having actually done it. Brothers and sisters, there is a vast difference between knowing about the Bible, knowing about God, knowing about Jesus, and actually doing it. A big difference. To claim your identity as a follower of Christ, you have to transition that knowledge from here to here to here. It cannot stay here. You cannot just believe in Jesus here. You cannot just listen to the Bible here. You cannot just take in the remote facts here without ever moving it to here and here. This is not salvation. This is salvation. Actually doing it. You have to know what is right, not from just reading about it or hearing about it or hearing a sermon on it. You have to experience what it actually means to do it. By the way, those things are good. Hearing about it, reading about it, studying about it, praying about it, talking about it, all very helpful. I would encourage you to do those things too. But like anything else in life, The best way to know it is to do it. You have to do it. To join Jesus as he stands before Pilate and rightfully acknowledge that, yes, we are followers of the resurrected King. That is who we are. Not because I know the story about him, not because I'll go to a church that talks about him, not because I have a Bible that talks about him, not because I watched a movie about it, but because I actually do what Jesus did. We're not going to be the knowers about Jesus or the talkers about Jesus or the experts of the subject of Jesus. We're going to be followers of Jesus, the ones who do what Jesus did so that we might really get to know him, to claim our identity as the children of God. That is what it means to claim your identity. Can I get an amen? Amen. Oh, yeah, we don't like that one, do we? It's a hard one. It's a really hard one. But when Jesus stands before Pilate and says, "It is just like you said, I am the King," one day we're going to stand before a judge as well. But our judge is going to be Christ. And the judgment is not going to be based on what you know about. It's going to be on what you lived about. How did you actually live your life? Sunday morning, don't cover up Friday night. Bible class doesn't cover up sinful living. It has to actually impact you to where you come to know Jesus and do things differently. So my prayer for you, my prayer for us as a congregation, is that we will not just be a people who know about Jesus, but the people who know Jesus and actually follow him in what he says and what he does. And if we can pray for you, encourage you, lift you up this morning, won't you come now as we stand and as we sing?